Hello, I am just delighted to see all of you. It's the end of the afternoon and the room we have standing room only, so thank you for coming. I'm Lisa Boleg and I'm professor of applied social psychology at the George Washington University in the Department of Psychology. And this first, you just have to take in the Philadelphia skyline. I'm going to be talking to you about research that we did in Philadelphia between 2007 and 2010. And Philadelphia is often referred, has this moniker as a city of neighborhoods. And so one of the things that we're interested in looking at is the impact of neighborhood effects on sexual risk with black heterosexual men. I have no relationships to disclose. I'm going to talk a little bit, I'm going to start with just a really general sort of 101 of neighborhood effects so that we're all on the same page about what I'm talking about. I'm going to tell you a little bit some of the literature on neighborhood effects in health and neighborhood effects in sexual risk. The latter will be quick because there's not much. A little bit about Philadelphia and why Philadelphia was such an ideal place to look at this model that we tested of neighborhood effects on sexual risk for black heterosexual men, tell you a little bit about our model, our methods, what we found, and then conclude with some implications and challenges of doing neighborhood effects work, particularly in the context of sexual risk. So when we talk about neighborhood context effects, there are lots of different ways of looking at this, and researchers from public health and psychology, to a lesser extent, have looked at a variety of different indices or indicators of neighborhood context. And some of these include sort of social disorder, whether there's violence or, you know, other criminal activity, the environment, the structural environment, boarded up buildings, abandoned buildings, broken windows, which you've probably heard of, proportion of poverty, things like social disorganization, like whether they're in the... This is debatable, but well beyond the scope of what I have time to talk about. But the proportion of married couples living with children less than 18, and then these sort of neighborhood processes, sort of such as collective self-efficacy. So, for example, do you live in a neighborhood where if there's crime, somebody's going to pick up the phone and call the police? If there's some type of violence, are people going to intervene? And so these processes between neighbors, and you know, when you think about sort of the context of where you live, there's abundant empirical evidence telling us that where we live tells us so much about our health. And so we have studies showing a link between neighborhood context and substance use, for example, or domestic violence, depression. HIV is trickier. We're talking often about sort of sexual behaviors, and so whereas one can easily see how a neighborhood effect, like not having a structural neighborhood effect, such as not having sidewalks or not having access to grocery stores could be linked to obesity, it's a little trickier trying to imagine how the context of a neighborhood might shape something like sexual risk. And so this is exactly what we were interested in exploring in this study. So a little bit of the background. There is some research, most of it done by Dr. Carl Lechtin at the Johns Hopkins University, who's really been at the vanguard of looking at neighborhood effects and sexual risk with heavy drug use populations in Baltimore. And so there's found that sexual risk is increased by more people who live in more negative neighborhood contexts. And this has been found with predominantly black injection drug users. There's also been some interesting work showing this as well for men who live, gay men who live in neighborhoods, multi-ethnic neighborhoods, with higher proportions of same-sex households. And then the converse has also been true, too, that there's been studies that have shown a decrease in sexual risk or a decrease in cocaine use for white gay men who live in those neighborhoods. And so, again, a very sort of small literature based on neighborhood effects and HIV risk, but one that's really so interesting to explore and one that I hope to see more opportunities for research and interventions. So a little bit about the city of neighborhoods. Philadelphia is the largest city in the East Coast, and it is also the poorest. Of the top 10 most populous cities in the U.S., Philadelphia ranks among the poorest. It also has the distinction of being the highest deep poverty city, large city, and these are in a deep poverty city is one with incomes that are less than half of the poverty rate. And just to give you some comparison, that's in Philadelphia, that's 12.2% nationally. The deep poverty rate is around 6.3%. And in terms of HIV, our work is focused on Black heterosexual men. And, you know, there's evidence of this sort of generalized epidemic in low-income Black neighborhoods that are showing that there's so much we don't know about heterosexual transmission. What we do know is that the virus is more efficiently transmitted from men to women. And so we're very much interested in sort of that group that's not as evident in the empirical work on HIV. And in Philadelphia, cases have sort of stabilized, but in 2009, heterosexual exposure accounted for 21% of the new HIV cases among men who listed heterosexual exposure as their leading category. So a little bit about the study, and I would be remiss in not pointing out Janae Massey, who's sitting there, who was oversaw recruitment of the study, and the study would not have been done without her. And so our eligibility criteria for the study was you had to live in Philadelphia, you had to be a Black man, so had to self-identify as heterosexual, report having sex, unprotected sex report vaginal sex in the last 2 months. And we did a variety of sort of time-based, venue-based sampling that Janae was instrumental in. That's far more complex than I have time to tell you. We offered them a $50 cash incentive, and they came. This was a cross-sectional study. They came to the project offices and completed the ACOSI. We also had a qualitative component with focus groups and interviews that I won't talk about today. So basically, this was the model we tested, and this model is based on Carl Latkin's work in Baltimore. And what we used as a higher order factor, neighborhood context, and we used Ewert and Suchday's model. They have a city stress inventory that they did with younger kids, and we modified this and added some items to really reflect some of the experiences the men talked about in the qualitative research. So we had neighborhood disorder, so a lot of that was sort of the spatial stuff. Is there gang violence in your, you know, is there a shooting gallery near your home? We added questions about personal violence. Have you been attacked as a, in your neighborhood? And then we had another dimension of neighborhood threat where we asked about exposure to violence of other people in the neighborhood. And what we did is we hypothesized that there would be significant direct pathways between neighborhood context, depression, substance use, and sexual risk. And then we hypothesized that there would be significant indirect effects of the relationship between neighborhood context and sexual risk going through depression and substance use. A little bit about our participants. So these are 526, and what you will see here, the mean age is 28, 29. This is a predominantly low-income, low-education sample, where we have well over half the majority of the sample reporting high school or some high school or GED, low incomes, and 64% of the sample reported that they were unemployed. And different measures we used, so we included, I've already told you about the Ewert and Suchday that we adapted. Substance use, we asked them about last 30 days, had one drink, binge drinking, marijuana. Depression, we used the PHQ-9 to assess that. And then we created a sexual risk ratio where we looked at sort of number of partners, number of vaginal sex, in the last 2 months, and number of times they reported condom use. And in terms of data analysis, we tested sort of model fit using chi-square test statistic and Bentler's indices for approximate model fit. And then we used M+7.11 and followed Anderson and Gerberstein's two-stage model, which the first stage of this involves fitting a measurement model and then testing a full structural model. And our results are that as hypothesized, all of the different paths in the model were significant, except the indirect pathways between neighborhood context and sexual risk going through depression. So anytime depression was in that model, it was not significant. So this is one way where our findings departed from Lackin's work. And so some limitations of this work. One is a cross-sectional design. Two, as always when you're doing sort of HIV work, the social desirability bias in terms of what men reported or may have felt uncomfortable reporting about their sexual risk behaviors, the gender of their partners, their drug use, for example. That said, I should say that drug use in this sample was so low that we ended up having to sort of combine some of the different variables because reported drug use was far lower, so it was mostly marijuana and alcohol drinking. We relied on self-report data. This is what the men are telling us about their neighborhoods, and so you can see that the value of future studies using sort of geospatial data, which sort of this study informed the next study that Dr. Heckert is going to talk about in a little while, where we are using GIS measures, and more sort of multi-level aggregated data from, say, the U.S. Census Bureau. It's not clear whether we can generalize the results from Philadelphia that has all these sort of unique neighborhood characteristics to other areas, other cities, other populations, rural effects, for example, we can't answer that. Middle and upper SES black men, we don't know. Black, gay, bisexual, MSM men, it's not clear. However, despite these limitations, I think that this work has a lot of important implications for future work, particularly given the growing advocacy for more social structural context in terms of HIV. So one of them is the importance of multi-level approaches well beyond the level of the individual. I often describe myself as a frustrated psychologist because in psychology, you know, the individual is a unit of is the unit of analysis, and so increasingly we're seeing that these are factors well beyond the individual that may shape sexual risk. There's a need for work to find out how is it that these factors, living in a building with broken windows, how exactly does that get into the body to translate into sexual risk? We don't really understand that. And related to that is, what factors other than the psychosocial might explain this link between neighborhood and risk, right? So, because typically, historically, it's always sort of depression or some aspect of mental health that is in the bridge. In our study, that wasn't the case. That was the non-significant pathway. It had nothing to do about depression, raising all these questions about, you know, factors other than the psychological. Another question is, so, all right, what if there is an effect of neighborhoods on sexual risk? What would that intervention look like, right? It would have to target everybody in the neighborhood. What would that look like? And then related to that, a big challenge is the funding one. NIH is not funding you to improve neighborhoods. You know, we live in a very sort of disease-specific funding climate, so you're funded to reduce sexual risk, and there you can see where an individual level approach is ideal, because you just, you know, okay, you can measure whether condom use increases as a result of this intervention. Neighborhood effects are so much trickier, and so there are lots of sort of more challenges that I see of this work in terms of, okay, what's the next step? And for the next step, I give the final word to Carl Lackin, who did this wonderful article on neighborhood effects and HIV risk in the American Psychologist. And what he says is, abandoned buildings per se do not cause HIV acquisition. However, abandoned buildings may be settings where HIV risk behaviors occur. They may be stressors or reduce collective efficacy, or they may be an indicator of neighborhood social economic status. And so the work here, as I see it, is sort of for us to know more about this inner circle. What is the relationship between these abandoned buildings and HIV risk, and how do we intervene? Thank you. And I just want to acknowledge, well, I have a few minutes. The study was funded by the NICHD, and my co-investigators are David Malibranch, who's now University of Pennsylvania, and Jean Tishon. And I want to highlight Tor Nealens, who's a consultant on the study who did all of the SEM analyses.